Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond. Blech.
What's up with it, y'all? Man, don't change that sound. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that sound. Wiggly.
Yeah, this is Cassidy, the hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy, Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dollars, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw. And you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio. And I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
Hey, what it ain't, what it do. Chilly Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West, y'all.
All right, we are now at episode 566 of Off the Cuff Radio. I'm your host, King Eric, the Media Assassin, and this show is sponsored by Fleetwood and the Cot Pickers, Screwball Radio, Buddy Boy Entertainment, and Da Vinci Clothing. Got my host, T-Max, with the facts on the line. What's good?
Man, what's going on? Another tremendous Thursday on a fresh old PC frequency. I am live and direct as well as your head host, King Eric the Ruler. Shout out to our co-host, Barry Lottison, and Lady Chinchilla, and of course, 30 Days of Radio. Shout out to DJ Cookup in New York. And we have a special show tonight. Where do I begin? Our guest that we have on tonight is a dear friend of mine. We go back over 10 years. This woman is the epitome of resilience, perseverance, kindness, benevolence, deal with the shit when needed, creative, and passionate. And she used to, you know, disclaimer, she used to work, you know, in the adult industry. And we forged a friendship. So this is especially special for me because pretty much as she was leaving the business and transitioning to regular life and adding the title of Magnificent Mother, you know, to her resume along the way. So I basically saw her through the last 10 years of her transitioning out to the regular life, to overcoming obstacles that would have taken down people, and she has risen like the phoenix and is still rising. She is a poet, she is an author, and an all-around awesome human being. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, from Los Angeles, California, the consummately professional and profound, Candy Baby, a.k.a. Candace Harvey.
Hey, girl. Hey, you gonna make me cry before we even get started. I came with the energy and you trying to pump
man,
this here.
That man is the Michael Buffer of these intros, man.
T-Max.
That man is the Michael Buffer of intros for real, man. That's why I be like, yo, man, we need to cut this through the bag.
Man. You're supposed to introduce me as a gutted chick from South Central.
He'll make you feel poor like you're coming out to the ring for a prize fight. Or he'll make you feel like you're top tier.
Yeah, it makes me feel good. Thank you so much for that introduction. Thank you so much, King. Thank you guys for having me here at Off the Cuff Radio. I'm excited to be on tonight.
Man, look, this has been a long time coming, boo, and we are so happy to have you on the show. You know, definitely. You know, you got a story. And, you know, once again on this show, for all of our listeners out there, y'all know that in terms of how we do it, we always want to show the real side, the human element, you know, how things really are out there. Because in the entertainment industry, we know how things can get twisted up, how they're misconstrued, how they're even misinterpreted, and how everything ain't always what it seems. And once again, you know, you being our guest, you know, you have a very, very diverse experience in terms of living, you know, in terms of how you came up, things you went through, of course, being in the adult industry, we're going to get to that, you know, how you got in, how you transitioned out, what was going on during the time you did, and what you're doing now in terms of, like I said, adding author, you know, to your resume. So shit, let's get it, man. Tell us a little bit about yourself. We got time.
All right, where do I start? I am, as you said, Candy Baby, a.k.a. Candace Harvey, a.k.a. Taisha Harvey. My pen name is Candy Baby. I adapted that name because the name Candy Baby was given to me by a very special person who is no longer here with us. I spent a total of 17 years in the adult industry. God. I don't know where to start. Put me with a question. I don't know where to start. Where do I start with this story?
Well, we're going to start with you from, you know, Candace Harvey to, you know, ultimately who would become Fiona Monroe. And then, you know, we go from there. Tell us about, you know, where you're from in California, where you grew up in L.A.
I'm from all over Los Angeles. I don't claim a particular part of Los Angeles because I went to 8 different elementary schools. I've lived on the west side of L.A. I lived in Inglewood. I've lived in Compton. I lived in South Central. I stayed in the jungles. I think I was living in the jungles when I first met you. I've lived all over Los Angeles, and gang culture is thick in my family. So I got family from all necks of the woods. I might be in the Bloods, and I know some of them. I might be in the Crips. I know some of them. I know some of the Hoovers. I know a little bit of everybody because my family is so big, and I'm all over L.A., South Central. That's where I'm from. I'm from L.A. I'm just an L.A. girl.
So what was it like growing up out there in terms of, you know, just your life? And, you know, because a lot of times people have an idea of L.A., especially from the street and the gang culture. And the gang culture and the street culture are the same, but they're also two different things, because when you're in a gang, you're affiliated with a direct crew, as opposed to being in the street, you just do street things. What was it like for you, you know, and your family, you know, your brothers and sisters, you know, just growing up out there and what you all, you know, and you specifically, you know, experienced?
I knew as far as gang culture goes, it was something I never wanted to be a part of, because growing up as a kid, we've been sitting on a plant outside and have the bullet shells sitting in the yard and stuff like that. Literally been outside where you hear somebody on the porch saying, I don't know if, can I cuss or do I need to watch
absolutely
my language?
No, you
off the cuff radio. We do what we do.
Okay, all right.
Shit up here.
I'm
go
standing
with
on the porch and we playing outside and it's a nigga standing on the porch and he's like, fuck crap. And the next thing I know, he busting while we standing outside playing like we not even there, and even having a bullet shell hit my head before. So, and even the police kicking in the door and looking for my mom and stuff like that, and me telling my mom, hey, stay where you're at. Do not come over here because they looking for you, okay? I'm going to call grandma, and that's at 10 years old. So I've seen a lot coming up as far as gang culture. I done had what we call our uncles, but was really my mama homeboys coming to house after hitting a lick, and they got the bullet wounds, and she gets the tweezers and shit, and she pouring peroxide and bandaging them up until they could get to a doctor because they can't go immediately. So growing up within it, it made me never want to be a part of that life. But I still ended up in some parts of the life. And I always tell people, I was raised by pimps, hoes, hustlers, gangbangers, and drug dealers. So I was going to adapt to either one of the lifestyles somehow. I was going to succumb to that. And mine just ended up being the sex industry. That's what I gravitated more. The players, the pimps, the working girls, seeing them come in with money and jewelry and stuff like that. That caught my eye more so than being outside fighting and messing my clothes up and my hair up and stuff behind neighborhoods I didn't own, streets I didn't own. That's LA.
Yeah,
growing
outside
up in gang culture.
Yeah, outside was different back then because there was a lot of lessons to be learned dealing with the underworld, because what people also don't understand is that those people, yeah, they could be labeled as that, but they also had a lot of games, a lot of wisdom as well.
There was a lot of gang violence. I don't know, maybe because I'm getting older, it don't seem like it was as bad as it is
game.
Now.
I said game, like as in, you know, verbiage.
Verbiage?
Yeah, I said game. Yeah, like
game.
You know, where you, yeah, like game, like as in them giving you advice, knowledge, and ways to carry yourself, and you know, survival techniques.
Yeah, that was definitely more game given than it is now.
Yeah,
there was a lot of lessons learned,
and
then you learn from watching people too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When not.
Go ahead.
You
there with us? Yeah,
I'm here.
Ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah, we had to make sure everything was running. Yeah, we had to make sure everything was running good, but we good now.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it was a little bit different than it is now, like with the older ones talking to us and stuff like that. They wanted us to be a part of that shit.
but it's crazy though, because you know, people, you know, you and me talk, you know, people, you know, we got people in LA, you know, people, you know, King talked to, I talked to, you know, a couple in particular who are heavy, you know, heavy hitters out there. They say, you know, for a lot of those older gangsters, you know, their thing is, you know, people who have not studied it or been in LA or are from there, if you're not one of those three things, then you really don't understand how serious it is, especially coming along during the 80s, you know, when crack hit, you know, and the crack epidemic, once it hit, you know, Los Angeles was just a snowfall of just violence. I mean, you know, the money that was being made, I mean, you had gangs, you know, crews that were once tight that ended up, you know, becoming rivals, you know, I mean, no matter where you go, whether you going on 60s, you know, in Crenshaw, you know, with the neighborhood 60s, whether you're on 83rd with the 8 trades, you know, whether you're on 552 with the 5 Dukes, you know, whether you're on 108 and 109 with the Figueroa, you know, the Denver Lane, you know, shit was affecting everybody.
It's still real out here in these streets. I'm not in the thick of it because I'm older now. So I don't get to see everything. I get to see it from a different viewpoint now. I'm not living. I don't surround myself. As a kid, I had no choice but to surround myself because the people who were taking care of me, who were responsible for me, were heavily involved. Now that I'm not around those who are heavily involved, I don't see it the same way that I used to see it. But not much has changed from what I am seeing, because they're still beefing the same way. And I always tell people, one thing about an L.A. dude is you don't know when L.A. dudes are upset. You don't know you dealing with a killer until you have somebody sneak up on you. That's the difference between the whole L.A. laid-back mentality and other places. You know, other places I go, you know somebody in some cities in the South that they say, ah, fuck all that. I ain't trying to hear nothing. Everybody knows it's time to go. But out here, it'll be a, I bet. And then the next thing you know, somebody comes up. Gone. Someone's missing. Now we got t-shirts,
yeah.
And now we got t-shirts, and we're doing fish fries.
You know, it's wild, funny you say that, because it's funny y'all say that, because y'all talk about when LA dudes get mad, because I want to send a big shout out to my man, Hood Homie Watts, I think that's his name. He's doing
comedy sketches about Watts Homie Kwan.
He be doing, like, funny comedy sketches about L.A. life and gang life and stuff. I'm like, man, he be matching those to a T.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does.
And
he does. He gives a real-life depiction of it. He's funny, too. I watch him a lot.
Yeah, you know, with the comedy of it, but it's also real because people have to understand, you know, and obviously I'm not a banger, never been to L.A., but talked to a lot of people from there, I've met a lot of people from there, and I understand the mentality. And the thing is, when you're dealing with a crew out there, especially individuals who specialize in violence, one of the tenets of that is, like, you know how we say in the street, the really bad nigga don't got to say shit because he knows what he's going to do to you when he's ready to do it? When you have that type of cold calculation with an individual, this is what I tell people, and this is, it's not just for L.A., this is just any part, because there are killers in every area. But them niggas that really try to hold the shit in, or they've already killed a few people. So their thing is, part of it is, they're not going to let you know when that storm's coming. They're going to let you think everything's all right, and they're going to catch your ass when you least expect it. It's a different life out there, because when you are right in the midst of a danger zone where literally any corner turn can mean life or death. Shit, and it's really not like that as much now as it was in terms of when back in the days, if they saw the opposite team saw your color, it was on sight. It's not as much like that anymore. Colors interchangeable in terms of who wears what, but depending on those rivalries still nonetheless, you know, and especially like they say, watch the hats you're wearing out there. You know, because it is real. And, you know, when you see situations with certain individuals, if you can walk away from stuff, walk away. If you got to fight it out, hell, if you got to shoot it out, that should be the last resort. But don't get out there in any situation trying to wolf off at these guys, because you got to understand at certain places, shout out to my boys, Ron Kine, Mitchie Slick, CJ, Meat Face, My Boss G, you know, or what they were saying on the song, you know, he'll shoot, you know, and, you know, my boss was saying at the end, you know, you got all day, all night hit niggas. And it's true. You literally got niggas in the hood whacking niggas is what they do. That's how they make their money, literally. So you're dealing with individuals that know how to maintain their emotions until it's time to let that shit go. When it goes, it's going to be a problem. But, yeah, I digress, though. So, I mean, when you – so in terms of it – as you started to get older and really seeing what was happening out there, obviously there was a lot of streets, you know, going on the streets. But obviously, you know, there's a lot of great things in the hood too. Tell us about some of the people you grew up with that ultimately would become, you know, celebrities in the game. Did you know any that would come from a young age?
Celebrities, you're asking me, like, people that I grew up with who are now famous? Thomas, T-Max, I didn't really go to school, so I didn't grow up with nobody. All my friends is hookers and pimps.
Well, we can get real off the cuff. Let's move past that question.
All my friends are hookers and pimps. Eighth grade was my last year of school. I didn't go to high school. I spent all my time in juvenile hall, and yeah, that was school for me.
So what was, so how'd you went, so the trajectory of where you had to take that detour, what led up to that point, and how would that kind of, you know, ultimately set the path for where you would go for that time being, for your entry into the industry?
I started off with a drug dealer, and then he went to jail, and I ended up dancing at an after hours, and that's when I met the dude who introduced me to another way of making money. And I stayed with that dude for some years. And after my 18th birthday, that's when I was introduced to the adult film industry. And I started doing movies when I was with him. And I stayed with him until I was about 18, and after my 18th birthday, I was with someone else, and I stayed with that person all the way up until I had my children, which I write about in the book that's coming out now, and also my memoir that's coming out after that.
Got you. So you said eighth grade was pretty much your last year of school, because on Off the Cuff, we're not going to be exploitative. That ain't what we do. But we also, too, want to give our listeners context of understanding how real it is out in the streets in terms of where, you know, a lot of, you know, young girls and boys get out there, you know, off the porch at a young age, you know, getting it. You were, you know, young when you got out there in terms of that. How common is it for a lot of young people before they hit 18 to kind of get caught out there like that in that life?
Back then, even now, like I work with youth. I work with youth who, oh my God, there's so many young girls now. But it was even more so then. It seemed like it was more of us back then than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
More so because of the internet, and they're not seen, so they're hidden in plain sight. We weren't really hidden in plain sight, and there were different terminologies for us, and it wasn't just as far as the game goes. It was game bangers too. I knew girls who was hitting licks and, you know, ride or die females. They were selling dope, robbing banks, robbing stores, and shit like that. Before they even touched their 18th birthday. Yeah, CYA was deep.
Yeah, California Youth Authority. Yeah. For those who don't know,
California
CYA, California
Youth Authority was deep.
Yeah, Gladys School.
So was Scudder and Onizuka and stuff like that. We was deep up in there. It was a lot of us. It was so many girls that they had to open up a new camp. They had to start sending us to Scott because they needed a bigger campsite to hold us. So it was a lot of us that was out there. That for the 80s babies, a lot of us was products of the crack epidemic. We had teenage mothers who were still finding themselves and growing up with us. So we was more so their friends and their homegirls instead of their kids. So it was a lot of us that was out there surviving, thugging it. I had friends, a bunch of friends, who I'm still friends with to this day that I met in the halls and shit like that who yeah, we was thugging it. We was surviving. This is how we about to eat. We got to figure out how we going to eat and sleep for the night because mama wasn't allowing us to come back home. Our home wasn't the place to be.
Man, and it's wild because a lot of people, you know, yeah, I mean, we're thinking about, you know, the Youth Authority, you know, a.k.a. Gladiator School, which was just any place you had to go. And, I mean, one of the homes especially that was super infamous, McLaren. You know, McLaren was like, oh, boy. I'm not even from L.A., and I heard stories about McLaren.
McLaren Hall was something else back in the day, but that was more so of a holding spot for bad kids and shit like that.
Right.
But we had a little, it was something going on right now. They got a whole lawsuit going on with the camps because it was going down with them grown-ass men fucking on little girls and shit like that.
When you see stuff like that out there, you know, and we give him a lot of grief, you know, but, you know, shout out to Vlad because he did a interview with Misty Stone. You know, Misty Stone talked about, you know, how she came in the game, because Misty Stone, and we're only saying this, you know, on off the cuff because this is documented. You can go on YouTube, watch the interview that she did with Vlad, and, you know, Misty tells it all. He cuts it up at like 85 different parts like he normally does. But Misty talked about how she made her entry into the game. And it's very specific, but she tries to kind of, if you read through the lines, you can tell she was out there at a young age, you know, near as I figure. You know, she talked about how she was like a young girl, you know, but near as I can figure, Misty was probably out there at least around 14, 15 years old. You know,
there was a lot of us. If you look at the records from Juvenile Hall between 99 to 2005, there was a lot of girls. The placements, it was a lot of girls because, I mean, if you've been touched on, for females, if they've been touched on at home without their permission, mm-hmm. their body's been violated, and somebody say, I'm going to pay you for this, and it's not being taken from you, there's an empowerment in that. Shit, this motherfucker about to give me some money from what the other nigga was taking from me, or what this nigga wasn't giving me nothing but some weed and, a little bit of drink and letting me spend a night at his mama house a couple of nights. But you going to pay me? I'm about to take the money. And then I can even go buy my own weed, my own drink, pay for my little room or whatever, and do it again all over tomorrow. So, I mean, it was a lot of girls that was out there really, really, really young for those reasons.
Yeah, Misty talked about an interview about how her dad had molested her. He was killed in a shootout with police. But, you know, Misty was like, you know, once again, y'all can watch Vlad's interview with her, and she talks about all of this. When you look at it, Andy, do you think the city of Los Angeles was prepared? Because obviously you all are the third highest populated city in the country. You all right around number two or three. You know, a lot of people don't know that L.A. County encompasses 88 different cities. Yes, y'all, 88 different cities. So do you think that the L.A. County was equipped for what was happening at the – where do you think a lot of this was starting at in terms of where all of this – the explosion just happened so exponentially that it was like – it wasn't like a gradual. It just, like, shot up.
I think the glorification of sex being so women selling sex. We had Lil' Kim. I was listening to Lil' Kim before I was old enough to really be listening to Lil' Kim screaming, I got this dude named Jimmy, used to run up in me, nighttime, pissy drunk, you know, like listening to that, listening to Sugar Free. I'm at, you know, pimping, like a bullshit, making some money. You know, we listening to all that shit, and music is magic, and it has a way of hypnotizing you. And I'm not saying that it's anything wrong with the artist at all. Nothing wrong with the artist. That was adult music that children shouldn't have been listening to. Parents should have been monitoring their motherfucking kids. I love Cardi B's little interview where she was like, you know who's supposed to be a role model to your kids? You, because I make music for adults. Our parents should have had a tighter hold on us. But listening to all of that and seeing, the first time I watched Pimps Up, Hoes Down, and I seen Famous Amy on the Jenny Jones show, and Famous Amy, they calling her a bunch of whores, and she like, so what? I'm getting money. Like, I'm getting money. I'm like, she getting money? How she getting money for it? I need to figure this out. Then I seen Pimps Up, Hoes Down, and they getting money. Like, you watching that, and it kind of stings the brain. And then not only I actually had hookers coming in and out my house with pimps coming in and out my house, and I'm watching these girls go out, and they going to go make money. I don't know how they're getting the money. I didn't figure that out until later. 2 + 2 is going to equal 4 eventually. But they going out and they coming back with $1,500, $2,000, $1,000. And I'm watching them come back with all of this money. Like, it was the surrounding at the time. That's what caused the big boom. And it was glorified in our music. It was on our television set. We had the Jenny Jones show and Maury Povich. And I forgot that other dude's name. But we have those people. We have
Montel
those, you
Williams.
Know, those people around. Huh?
Oh, Montel Williams. Think about Montel Williams.
No, nah, Montel, I don't think Montel had any hookers on his show, but I know
yeah.
Maurice Povich has some hookers on his show.
Yeah,
Ricky Lake had a couple of hookers on her show. You know, like they
talk about Jerry Springer.
Jerry Springer, yes, Springer. You know, and you, I mean, when you watch it and you see it, it puts this thing, you know, on the back of the brain. Hey, I'm about to go try this out. Let me see what this getting some money is all about.
And it's wild, yo, because to give it context, for the context, people have to understand that, you know, this is Los Angeles. So I'm going to give, you know, everybody a little history lesson. Porn, as we know it today, was not legalized until 1988. After the Supreme Court basically said, you know, we can't decide whether or not it's obscene or free speech. So basically, we'll just let the cities, the cities and the states decide for themselves if it's okay. So you got to think about it. From the 70s, you know, the 60s and 70s up until 1988, technically porn was illegal. You know, that's why a lot of those videos were so high in terms of like $100, you know, dollars back in the day because they were hard to come by. You had to be connected to get them. You know, when that ruling came down in 88, you know, it opened up the industry. And pretty much where it used to be in New York, where there were a lot of shoots, where's all the movie entertainment at? Hollywood, California, Porn Valley, Chatsworth, Van Nuys, you know what I mean? So it was on and popping, you know? So, you know, you saw that really in the late 80s and early 90s to really become a thing, and that's when it really kind of started to become a major moneymaker. And instantly, you know, that's when you had the, you know, studios like Vivid and all of them that would come, and I mean, they would become multimillionaires. You know, Stephen Hirsch, all those guys. You know, Larry Flynn, of course, with Hustler Entertainment.
Hustler.
Yeah, rest in peace. Yeah, West Coast Productions, you know, all them, man. So, and you all were right in the middle of it. So you all saw this, you know, you mentioned Sugar Free, one of the legends, you know, from Pomona. Shout out to him and Uncle Coke, you know. So it's like, what was the player mentality in L.A.? Because there, a lot of people look at pimps, and they think about the fedoras and the suit, you know, the ostentatious jewelry. But you got pimping all over from New York to Chicago, even Wisconsin. Yes, y'all, I said
yeah,
Wisconsin because
yeah,
every year in Milwaukee,
Oklahoma.
That's where the players ball is. Huh?
Oklahoma.
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 You know?
I mean, it's pimping and hoeing across the country. Right. At L.A., players back then was laid back just like an L.A. gang member. They didn't necessarily – I ain't never seen nobody in them – what's his name? The mascot. What's his name? Bishop Magic Don Juan. I ain't never seen them walking around like him. I done been to a couple of players' balls where a few dudes came in dressed like that. But for the most part – look like a regular dude, just like you. Tennis shoes, a hat. Back then, Coogee was tight, you know. Walk up on you with some Coogee jeans on and a Coogee sweater. They did sweaters, like, up and down the streets and stuff like that. But they didn't look like the whole little high heel shoes and stuff like that.
Right,
it didn't look like the stereotype. Regular dudes, gaiters, button down, corduroy pants, and all, like, you know, it didn't look like them.
Got you. So once you get in the game and you really start learning how the pimps are putting it down on that Mac method, you know, you being on, you know, learning how to track work, you know, where they got they lay it a strip, you know, where they let it rip. What was like once you get off the porch and you really start seeing it? What are you seeing as you go along in terms of the clients, what they're requesting, how you stay safe in all of this? Because we've heard the stories about, you know, girls getting cut up, dumped all over. You know, I mean, a lot of shit is
is serious with it. Go ahead with it.
How do you stay safe? There's really no way. It's all off of instinct and gut feelings. That's the best way. A lot of girls back then used to say the pimp was for protection, but can no one protect you if you walking in a hotel room by yourself or you getting in a car by yourself? Even on those scenes, can no one protect you? I mean, back then we had AIM, so you could trust that them AIM results is right, but don't nobody know what the other person's been doing offset in those 30 days between the next testing time. So,
right.
I mean, it's really gut instinct, and grandma's prayers is what saved me. I tell people that all the time. It was my grandmother's prayers that kept me safe because I've been in situations, I've been in a lot of situations. There was abuse as far as, like, with the pimp, but I don't like to push that narrative. I worked in when I first went what they call Square, I worked within the human trafficking spectrum. And when you've been disempowered for so long and you've taken on a personality for so many years, most of your life, you take on a new personality and a new platform of empowerment. And there was a lot of things in my narrative that I was taking on kind of that I didn't really believe in necessarily. So I don't want to push the pimp like, oh, he's such a bad guy, because most of those guys come from the same environment as I do. They come from the same trauma. That's the reason why
Right. We're
easily trauma bonded. They come from the same abuse, the same neglect, the same needing a family and stuff like that. They come from those same backgrounds as I do, and it's mostly black men. When they scream pimp, the first thing anyone thinks of is a black man. There was abuse somewhat in that relationship. Yeah, there was fighting. There was abuse. But what nobody talk about is some goddamn white tricks.
let's get into it. Because
That's where this shit used to come in. And it's been times where I done had to fight my way out of situations because the motherfucker wants their money back and they felt like they didn't get what they wanted. They wanted a little bit more. And another thing is, are you fucking all the time? Actually, I ain't give up that much pussy. Pussy was the last thing to go. That was the very last thing, because I'm going to try to talk you for your hour and tell you it's been an hour, dance for you a little bit, play with you. Pussy going to be the last thing on the menu. Pussy come when it's like, God damn it, okay, this motherfucker not going to let me cut out. I got to get on a little coochie. So that was more often the last thing to come. Like, you got to see me, you know, especially when I started doing the videos. You didn't see all the fucking I did on that video. That man was fucking the shit out of me. You should have got off to that, sir. But the abuse came more so from my clientele. And I've had situations where I've had police officers that you want to go to jail or you want to go home. That's something that they don't talk about in a lot of them interviews that I did before and I write about in my book. You come in, the police take you around the corner and they're supposed to be taking you to jail and they take you somewhere else and then they take it from you. That's something that they don't talk about a lot of times. I was more unsafe in handcuffs sometimes than I was before, you know, I got – while I was on the street or working the casinos or even taking the phone calls when I moved up to that level. And I started off as a minor. So the pimp kind of was like a necessity because I didn't have no ID to get around. I couldn't really move around. I was a kid, you know, so he provided me with the IDs and shit that I needed in order to get around. And I was going to be doing what I was going to do regardless. When people feel so sorry, like she was a little kid, I was going to be doing what the fuck I was going to be doing regardless, whether he was there or not, because I didn't feel like I could go home. And also, a family system was provided, a family that I did not feel like I had at home. was provided. My wife in laws was my sisters. It was a sisterhood there. I got you, you got me. And we often looked out for each other. And the same thing with my best friends and my friends. I have friendships that I've had out of the game for 20-plus years. But we had each other, too. Like, bitch, this motherfucking get the trip and you call me, I'm coming in. We done pretended like we done had a gun, ain't got no gun, to get each other out of situations and some more shit. So that's safety was the question. Safety is gut feeling. Giving up coochie, that's the very end. And then some things I'm just not going to say that I did on the radio. A lot.
Understood. we understand, and we are not going to press you on that. But it's also when you saw the clientele, because there is an intrinsic link between because pretty much after the game got legalized, you had a lot of girls that this was pretty much, I mean, and even dudes, you know, John Holmes, you know, the legend, he was known for double dipping. You know, he did guys and girls. You know, and, you know, this is going back in the 70s. You know, ultimately he died in 88 of AIDS. But, you know, even then back in the day, you know, he was known to, you know, get paid heavy to have his time, you know, for people to have time with him. You know, Toy Clayton, you know, she's retired. She was another porn star. I think with Toy Clayton at the time I heard she was charging like $800 an hour. You know, you know, we talk to a lot of, we know a lot of females, you know, who are in the game, you know, and they told us stories off air. When you start looking at the clientele, Candy, that you were dealing with, because this is where people really want to know in terms of the people you were dealing with and the money that was involved, who were some of the big spenders? What was the – I'm trying to articulate it, but you kind of get – you and King kind of get what I'm saying with it.
You and I have private conversations, but I'm not Corinne Stephens. I won't, like, name names
right.
I've been with. But,
We're not asking for names. But, like, just the people, like, in terms of, like, businessmen, you know, like, where would they come from? Like, what would their – what was the – Yeah.
When I first started, like I told you, at an after hours. I actually got turned out by a trick, and I was walking down the street and I couldn't pay for my hotel room, and this guy pulls up on me and he's like, "Are you working?" I'm like, "I'm 14. I don't got no job." He's like, "Oh, are you working?" I'm like, "I don't got no job, but you could give me a ride." I'm 14, and you're like, "Let me tell you something. How about I'm gonna give you $100? You suck my dick." And I was like, first I'm like, "Nah." Then I said, "You got a condom?" He said, "Yeah, I got one. You gonna do it?" And the first thing went in my head is, I've been sucking dick for free all this time. Shit, this $100 to help me out right now. I need to pay for this hotel room. And I took the $100. And
no judgment here.
He took me to the after hours, and when I was working at the after hours, that was the only time that I had did it then until I met the pimp. And when I met the pimp, I was introduced to a different set of clientele. It started off with gang members and, you know, like little neighborhood randoms that I was dancing for. And then he started taking me to places where I was meeting businessmen. And I was meeting white men, and it was my first time being with older white men. And then it went from dealing with white businessmen to politicians and then sometimes celebrities. And I've dealt with men who are your everyday average Joe, and I've dealt with multimillionaires as well. I'm not going to sugarcoat it like I was just some big what's the Jewish chick name? Heidi Fleiss. I'm not going to sugarcoat it like I was Heidi Fleiss. But my clientele was a collaborative of everything. It was older white men, older Jewish men, Arab men. I've dated people who had their own planes and then flew me on planes to go with them places. We done flew out to different cities to go on dates and sit on rooftops. And I had guys that live in a one-bedroom apartment and got a Domino's pizza when I get there. So, like, I done had a variety of everything. And it
right.
wasn't
and,
all bad.
No.
It wasn't
no,
all bad.
You
know, it was fun. It was an adventure.
Yeah, and you know, the funny thing about it is, y'all, you know, me and my brother, we talk about this a lot on air, off air. You know, we talk to a lot of chicks who have been in it. You know, the money, because you have, you know, we know how the game works. You know, we were both, you know, King from Harlem originally. That's his roots in New York. You know, ours is when I jumped off the porch and hung around a lot of my folks and everything, you know, my people's in the street, I learned the game, albeit, you know, a little bit later on, but I got hit to it, you know. So you understand how it works in terms of especially where the money is. And when you start seeing the celebrity culture, because, of course, Corinne Stephens, she wrote in her book about the dalliances she had with Usher, you know, celebrities. And, you know, wherever there is, you know, it's funny because also, too, the former porn star Lavish Styles, you know, she just made it about as real as she could. She's like, every woman got $1 million between her legs. I was like, well,
definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Every woman does, definitely. And I'm not glorifying it and telling nobody's daughter to go out and sell. I wouldn't want no one to tell my daughter to go out. I wouldn't tell my daughter to go out and, you know, sell your little thing. But every woman does have $1 million and sitting in between her legs. And if she hasn't thought about it before, I mean, when the rent is due, you never know what you're going to do.
Man, look, when we look, because we saw Pimp Sub Hoes Down and we saw American Pimp, you know, and what was that? I say, King, who was that, Payroll or Shantae in American Pimp, where he was talking about, I don't care who he is. He's like, every woman has thought about selling pussy at one time or another.
Every woman has, once in her life.
You know, so when you think about it, it's something, and then we, you know, get into it, Candy, because we talk about, really it's become more prevalent now because of social media in terms of what we call trick culture. But the reality is trick culture has been going on. I mean, hell, we look at it, prostitution, you know, selling sex is old as time itself. You know, so this is not something that, you know, we can turn a blind eye to or be naive about, because the fact is pussy made the world go round. You know, what they say, was my girl Jazz, baby girl from HWA, hosted after, they said men pick, women choose, and pussy rules. And that's some game, because it's like when you look at shit, look, boo, even with the goddamn beast and rap, usually some of that shit starts out over a woman. We may
yep.
know about it, we might not know about it.
Even the beef with the
witch,
I'm gonna call it, with these little dudes and stuff, these little gang wars, would be behind a little some girl that got into it and called her brother when she should have left her goddamn brother out of it, or then called somebody, you know, or this bitch was with this nigga that she wasn't supposed to be with. It'd be behind, it'd be cooking somewhere in the mix.
The fuckery is frequent. Oh my goodness. So when you look at it from that side of it, and how the game operates, because, you know, when you're looking at the money that is cashed down, especially when we're looking at the Instagram models now, and we've heard some stories, you know, about how a lot of these girls get flown out to the Emirates, you know, how they, you know, and we know that oil money in the Middle East is like, I mean, look, you figure they're going to pay the, you know, you figure they're going to fly the girl out first class, what, around $5,000-$10,000. I mean, that's nothing for them, you know, but it's like when those girls get there, you know, we hear the stories about some of the stuff that those girls go through in terms of once they're there. When you think about how social media has changed the game, in terms of how women are putting themselves out there, especially with, you know, even with what we call thought culture coming up, what have you seen now that is different in this day than what you did even 15 years ago?
It's saturated now. It's saturated. Like, little girls don't want to grow up and be doctors and lawyers no more. Everybody want to be a city girl. You even got women with degrees that want to be city girls now. And 15 years ago, even when I was in the game, it was survival that brought me there. If I had any other route, if I had any other route to go or felt like I had another choice, if I had the option of, okay, I could go to school, I could graduate, I could be like the girls on A Different World, you know, one of them Huxtable girls, I would have went that route. But I was in survival mode. Now these girls aren't even doing it for survival. They're just doing it because, instead of using all their other options. So it's saturated. I want to get flown out. I want a nigga to get my nails done, my feet done. You got to pay my rent. A nigga call a bitch phone, all of a sudden all her bills is overdue. It's saturated. Everybody doing it now. And it wasn't as saturated then, because the ones that was in the game, we were so gutta and so good at what we do because we was there, because we were in survival mode. And that's how we ate.
Right.
That's how we ate. That's how we lived. So it was only a few of us in this underworld. Now it's just everybody. Girls turn 18, they want to go on OnlyFans. They don't. I don't even think they filling out college applications no more. They go to prom for the. They graduate from high school for the prom party, or whatever they call it, the champagne party, and that's about it. It's saturated. It's very, very saturated now. It's too many.
You know, right. And you know what's funny, man, because in the intro, and I said a lot of shit, I forgot to say, in terms of introspective, intelligent, and incredibly insightful that you are. You know, we've known each other for some years, and I mean, you always say something that's going to just bring it full circle. Because where you have a lot of the young girls today who want to be that, it's the same thing as a lot of these young dudes out here, you know, young niggas want to rap. You know, it's oversaturated. Everybody thinks that they're going to be, like a lot of these young dudes, they get out there. Exactly. Well, that too. You know, but everybody want to be a rapper. Everybody want to be a podcaster. You know, the girls, you know, and their thing is they want to get out there, you know, and I think it's because we see it from a perspective of everybody gets that attention online in terms of it. You know, social media has made it so much easier to be seen. And OnlyFans, you know, we don't judge nobody on the off the cuff or having OnlyFans or even subscribing to one. You know, I mean, you know, you like what you like. You do what you do. But one thing about it is that it's like anything. You know, and I tell you one thing, women will get humbled really the fuck quick on OnlyFans.
They sure will.
Boy, you think you that hot bitch in the street? Okay, bitch, we gonna see how, you know, you charge it $50 for what? Your content it ain't nothing? Or, you know, you not getting that attention like you thought you would get. You know, so it's different, like Meek Mill said, it's levels to this. You know, once you get out there on a wide platform, and then you find out how really popping that you are. We're just being real here. You know,
we don't like how everything is based off content.
You know, everything got to be for content these days. And a lot of people don't even have the form of knowledge. They don't have the understanding. They don't have the grit to create. They just make it for content purposes. If you can make it for content purposes, then you got to make it enjoyable for the most part. Like, let it have some merit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's always something that, you know, one thing about it is when everybody talks about it, it all comes down to money and wanting to make it, and we all want to be able to survive. And whatever your hustle is, you know, whether, you know, you work a 9-to-5 or you're on the block, it's all about understanding the politics of your position, where you're located, and how to maximize the most to get it. But it's also understanding that this, depending on what your hustle is, it ain't going to sustain. So we still got to talk about when you actually jump into the industry, when you start actually doing movies and the politics that go on with that. But man, I mean, we're just time is flying by. I mean, so much we got to talk about. When you look at the situation, because what you talked about earlier, Candy, about how a lot of young girls are getting out there about the situation you was in. We look at the situation with R. Kelly and what was going on and how, you know, that saga has, you know, for all intents and purposes, had the door closed. That door is closed now with his conviction. But when you look at it from that industry in terms of what he was doing and everybody knew that he was doing it, what does that say in terms of what we deal with in society about a lot of pedophilia with a lot of these grown men on young girls and even at times grown women on young men? How prevalent is that out there from what you saw?
When I was in 18, all my clients knew I was in 18. No one thought I was under, I was over 18. No one thought I was 18 years old. The person I was with at the time did not think I was 18 years old. Everybody knew that I was a minor. I feel like I always say I wouldn't change anything about the way my story was written, because it was written especially for me. But at the same time, if I do have one wish, I wish that somebody would have been like, come back, you know, little mama, you say you want to do this, but, man, let me send you to school or something. And when you finish with school, let's see what it's hitting for. Let's see if you still really want to do this. I wish anybody messing with a kid needs to be in jail.
Right.
All that, she going to be bad when she turn 18. Then you get your ass up out my house. You're looking at little girls. 16 is hood legal. No, it's not. 16 is a minor. When I think about shit I would say at 14, 15, 16, 17, shit, even at 18, I regret some of the shit I said at 25. Babies, leave babies alone. And it is very prevalent. People want youth. They want to snatch youth. And it's disgusting. And R. Kelly don't just need to be in jail, but the parents, no way in hell my kid would be in a studio with R. Kelly knowing his history. They asses need to be in jail, too. That's my personal opinion. Everybody needs to be in jail.
Right, right. And it's crazy, too, because in certain states, you know, in terms of consent, I think in New York, and we're not, you know, we're just giving facts. We're just stating we're not, you know, defending any other. We're just saying how it works in a lot of states. Because I believe the consent in New York, I believe, is 17. I think in Indiana, it's 16. I think in Hawaii, it's 16. I think in Florida, it's like 16 or 17. But it's still the fact of, you know, obviously in Virginia, it's 18. But it's like, you know, it's just to me, when you start, I just look at it from the perspective of me being a grown man, and even back then, it's like there's such a mentality difference. You know, it's like, you know, there's you know, not to mention the age gap, it's just a, you know, a whole mental difference. You know, it's just, you know, outside of bumping uglies, you know, what else could y'all really do? What type of conversations could you really have? It's just something that I think, you know, people have to look at more, especially in the Black community, because that is something that we do not mm-hmm. talk about enough, about a lot of that goes on, you know, in terms
yeah,
of these 16 situations.
16 is hood legal. I hear grown men say that all the time. 16, hood legal. Ooh, I got something for somebody with my 16-year-old when my baby turns 16. But 16, no, that's not hood legal. You cannot hold... When I have a conversation with a 21-year-old kid, my head hurts a lot of times. Let me tell you how they just pulled me on Instagram, and I had to tell this bitch, because she, boop, boop, nope, I ain't did that. What? Because she subbed me, and I'm like, what the fuck is a sub? I thought that was a sandwich at Subway, man. I have no idea what you're talking about. We don't even speak the same language. Did you see that meme she posted? What the fuck is a meme? I have no idea. We don't talk the same language, so I couldn't see myself doing nothing with a 21-year-old kid butt bumping uglies. And that's not even going to be fun, because you got to be grown and know what you're doing. Grown folks know what they're doing.
Right, right. So when you find yourself getting into the porn industry, of course, this is the Fiona Monroe, stage. How did you come with the name Fiona Monroe, and how did you find your way into the industry in terms of actually to start doing movies?
I was doing movies. I had an agent when I was 18, when I turned 18.
Mm-hmm.
That introduced me to the movies before, and then I stopped. I really didn't like doing movies because they took too long and it wasn't enough money. What they pay for a movie that takes 6 hours to make, I was making that in about an hour or two, a couple of hours.
Right.
So I stopped doing movies for a long time. I think I did one more before I became Fiona Monroe under Candy. And then I got a phone call, and me and the person I was with was talking, and he was like, yeah, go back into it. Boost your name up. It'll boost the escorting up. And just we'll do a few of them and, you know, get out. And the person I was with and someone else started connecting, and they hooked the movies up. I basically would show up. But it wasn't – I never liked movies. They didn't pay enough. They did not pay. And it's a lot of work. Those little 20-minute scenes – that people be watching, that shit takes 6 and 7 and 8 hours to make sometimes. I wasn't a big fan of the movie. It was fun sometimes. Being a fluffer is fun. Being a fluffer is a lot of fun. Take that back.
Not yet.
But actually being on camera is a lot of work.
Yeah. You know, when you think about it during that time, you know, y'all, because this is where it gets now as a black woman, because we've heard the stories about the pay discrepancies. You know, we interviewed Sierra. You know.
They don't pay black girls. Black girls, we make our money on the other end. I didn't make money necessarily on set for doing a movie. Doing a scene might make $1,000, $1,500, $1,200, and then some companies pay as little as $800 or $900 per scene. As far as the escort work that comes from it, my calls would go up and I could charge anywhere from $500, $750. I could charge those type of prices because in the client's eyes, I'm a porn star. But That's the branding. Yeah, that's building a brand. And Fiona Monroe, I was rebuilding a brand, and then, you know, I got pregnant in the middle of becoming Fiona Monroe, and I decided to walk away from everything. But Fiona Monroe came as a rebranding of myself. I was rebranding myself, and, it was really to boost the escort work up more so than the porn, because they don't pay black girls enough. They don't be playing, you know, they don't. Everybody love us. They want our rhythm, but they don't want our blues. They don't like paying us like the white girls.
Yeah, and it's crazy
or
because
some off-the-wall shit that they'll ask for us to do, like ghetto gaggers,
right.
Some shit I would never do.
Right, right. You know, I can't say, I'm not going to say on air that I've never watched a porn. Of course, we all have, but even with ghetto gaggers, that's, and I can say this, and God strike me down if I'm lying right now, ghetto gaggers is just not my thing, you know, because I don't do race humiliation, you know, black or white.
Yeah.
I don't do none of that, you know, and ghetto gaggers, to me, that's out. That's just something I'm like, no, there's a line that has to be drawn, and that's the one that needs to be drawn on that. But, you know, when you look at it in terms of how the money is made, because Heather Hunter is known, you know, as being the first black woman that was contracted, you know, with a company when she was with Vivid back in the day. And I know, of course, Jenna Jameson, you know, she had her contract with Vivid, you know, and from what I understand, if my facts are right, I think Jenna's contract was like $1 million a year. You know,
yeah,
this is
Jenna
before,
was.
Yeah. Yes, I mean,
Jenna
yeah,
was.
I mean,
Yeah, Jenna was making $1 million a year. I don't know the minimum of movies that she had to do.
And she was getting
yeah.
I'm not sure how many movies Jenna had to do, but yes, Vivid definitely did contract her. I worked with Score, and I did a lot with Glory Hole and a few
Dog
West
Park,
Coast
Dog
videos.
Park, but yeah.
Mhm. But the pay wasn't the same, and then it wasn't the same for all the black girls either, because I done been on set and a girl done told me, yeah, I got paid $600, and I'm like, $600. Bitch, you was doing the most. So, the pay grade wasn't shit. But what I can say is, I'm not gonna dog the porn industry out too bad. They do need to, I'm glad that now people can make their own content and black girls can make their own content and get paid directly from some of the porn sites when they are in that industry instead of even going through a company, because they don't pay fairly as far as the black girls. So black girls not making that much money. But what we do is we make money on the back end because, you know, don't nobody hustle like a black girl.
And I mean, also, too, you know, interracial is really big. You know, a lot of people, you know, forget about that. Interracial is, like, the highest selling. But the trick is that, you know, and I'm not going to say her name on air, and I'm not going to say who she was dealing with, although the girl she was dealing with is a good friend of mine who's in the industry still to this day. it was a situation about, because we know in terms of the interracial movies, there's a certain aesthetic that they want black girls to have in terms of the regular look, maybe not what the white studios would term as too ghetto or too black, you know, i.e. a lot of weave, tattoos, you know, all of that. But this one girl I know of in this area, she was trying to get into the game, and a chick who I know was in the industry was, you know, trying to give her about how she needed to, you know, grow her hair out and, you know, this, that, and the other. And, you know, she got a lot of tattoos and everything. She's thick. She's not fat. She's a thick girl. You know, she's all about body positivity, natural. And old girl was trying to tell her, like, the look you have is not what's going to get you into the movies, especially the big money movies with them big studios. So they had some kind of falling out about that. But from that perspective of it, when you're thinking about what it is, because you got to understand your clientele. And when we look at where porn was, from the mid-1990s to now, of course, the internet's come in. How do you think internet piracy has changed the game in terms of productions and overall sales?
I think that people being able, you mean like people being able to make their own porn, like make their own
that
homemade videos?
Too, that and also people and also, too, the movies getting bootleg heavy.
I'm pretty sure that's taking a toll on a lot of companies. I don't have stats because I haven't looked at stats, so I don't want to give no numbers and give false information. I'm real big on making sure I know what the hell I'm talking about before I open my mouth.
Understood.
I'm just giving an opinion, and I think it probably has taken a lot away from the porn companies bootlegging and people being able to make their own content. I think it's good for the performers.
Right.
Because like I said, why should a performer get paid $800 or $1,000 and the company makes $1 million off that one video circulating? Like, they still have rights to movies I did 10 years ago. I can't even have those movies taken off the internet if I wanted to because I have changed the direction of my life. They're there forever, and they're still going to make money off of those. I've had tried to have them taken down. They still keep popping back up somehow. Why not own your own rights? And, yeah, bootleg that shit. Make your own money off of it. Since you can do it now. I don't think there's anything wrong because they were cheating the performers from the beginning.
You know what that sounds like, what you just said? It sounds like the record industry.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like going independent. You know, it's the same thing. Going independent and you're able to do it yourself. You know, we champion the independent spirit. You know, Off the Cuff Radio, we're an independent program. You know, we don't have the big sponsors. You know, we would have it if the situation is right. But, you know, we understand, like, we'll tell anybody, ain't no get going of doing it yourself like doing it yourself. You know, and if you can find your audience, you know, you get out there and do it, especially in a market where the demand is always going to be there, but you have to find where you can really maximize the profit off of. Now, when we look at when you were transitioning out, because we know that it's so hard, you know, we've seen a lot of, you know, chicks who we know personally, you know, when they decide to move on, you're ready to do it, but maybe not everybody else is ready to let you do it. What was that decision like when you decided to leave the industry?
It was, I'd have the twins. I have my baby, and I'm not going to go all the way into the last time with them, but, like, I knew when I found out I was pregnant that I was fizzing my way out. I was fizzing out. And because I always said if I had children, I wouldn't raise my children in an environment where there was pimping and hoeing, gangbanging, none of that. All the things that I grew up with, I promised myself I wouldn't allow around my children.
Understood.
So when the moment I found out I was pregnant, I knew I was on my way out. The hardest part was starting, knowing all the money that I had made, because I fucked with a pimp, which means pimping got all the money. if I could do it all over again, that's one thing I would take back. I probably wouldn't, after I turned 18, I wouldn't have gave nobody no money. But starting all over again and going into the unknown, because I had spent so many years, like, first name whore, middle name whore, last name whore. Everyone that I was surrounded, my whole life. It wasn't, see, for some people, it's actually a game, and that's why I say it's so saturated now, but it was a lifestyle for me. It was my lifestyle. Like, all I knew was pimps, hookers, tricks. That's all my whole world was surrounded for almost two decades. So transitioning from that, and then even, like, the lingo, like, I didn't speak the same language as most of the squares that I was running into. So it took a different type. It took so much resilience and perseverance in order to make it through, because it's been so many times, especially in the beginning of my transition, where I just wanted to turn around and say, you know what, let me just go ahead and go back to what I know how to do. But I didn't know what was in front of me, so I kept going. I kept pushing. No matter what, I'm still going to push through this, because I have two people whose childhood and adulthood and growth depends on me. So no matter what, I have to make something work. And that's what kept me going. But you promised, you know, I was homeless for a little while with my kids. I went through a bunch of agencies, because I remember one time when I was arrested, they kept saying, you're a victim of human trafficking. So I looked up human trafficking and I started talking to some agencies, but nobody would house me because I wouldn't give them no name of no pimp or anything to arrest. I'm like, I'm not giving you guys a name just for the sake of a place to stay. That's not going to work for me.
Right. I mean, and I was there through all of that. You know, we got history, I was there through all of that.
Yeah, like, people wouldn't house me because I wasn't giving up no names or anything like that. And it was like, I'm not going to do that. And then going through, once I finally, like, became stable with housing, and then I had my first square job, which, oh, Lord, I wasn't making shit. I seen that first paycheck. I was ready to go back then. I said, who the fuck is Spica?
Right.
Nigga fighting unemployment and all these other employments and taxes. What the fuck? I worked hard for a whole week, 2 weeks for this. But learning to manage money, learning how to live, it's a totally different lifestyle where you make enough money and you go in the store and you don't look at price tags to where now you weigh in, do I get the Scott's tissue or do I get the store brand? cutting coupons and stuff like that, I didn't have to do those things before. So living a normal life, it was a hell of a transition for me. And going through the phases of working within the anti-human trafficking movement, that was also a hell of a journey. And they do, I'm not going to say the movement does not have a lot of ideologies that I respect, but they have so many that are so far-fetched from my understanding of the game and what it is. I'm not saying that stories aren't true that I've heard in those rooms, but they're not necessarily the stories that I've ran into throughout my experience. But navigating through go ahead.
No, I guess I was going to say, when you talk about human trafficking, we look at the situation with Epstein and all that has been said about that situation. What are your opinions on how that case was investigated? It ultimately led to his conviction. And, I mean, you were there, so you understand what was going on in terms of, you know, not with him, of course, but you were in the business, so you understand what was going on. Got you.
He was a trick. Mm-hmm. Epstein was a trick. He was definitely a trick. I always say he was a trick. He was not a trafficker. He was a trick. But him being a white man in power, and him knowing other white men in power, they will never identify him as a trick because they have to identify him as themselves, and they threw him under the bus as a trafficker. But I do not believe Epstein was a trafficker. He wasn't no pimp. He was a trick. It was a trick. He probably tricked with the minors. A lot of tricks did trick with minors. I was a minor, so I met a lot of tricks in power that tricked with minors, that like young girls. But he was a trick all day. He was not no damn trafficker. And I say that to the end. He was a trick.
And, you know, and I feel what you're saying with that, you know, because of how that case unfolded, because especially when we're going with the Me Too movement that extends to a lot of different areas of what is supposed to be protection of the most vulnerable and the exploited. I mean, it's hard to believe. I was like, well, already like 4 or 5 years ago, including his death, you know, where this whole thing became a news issue. You know, everybody, I mean, look, I think we're still waiting on this goddamn list that they talked about all these celebrities up there. And you know, and King and y'all, you know me. I don't do conspiracies at all. But I have said this. If there's a list of high-end people, we ain't never going to see it. Because the names
we never going to see that list. We ain't going to see that damn list.
We ain't never going to see it. I tell everybody. We ain't never going to see that list. You know, because they've been talking about that for years. Well, you know, there's this list and the speculations of who's on. I'm like, nigga, we ain't never going to see that shit.
Nah, we ain't going to see that list. That's what I think about that. I think he was a trick and we ain't going to never see the list.
But that's also something to the transition. You know, Henny Flame, real name Jennifer Ketchum, a few years ago, she wrote a piece online about when she transitioned out, of course, Aurora Snow, she used to be in the game heavy, and she wrote a piece about when she decided to leave, you know, and it was, and both of them, for our listeners out there, if you go to Bing, because I like using Bing myself, punch up Penny Flame, Jennifer Ketchum, and Aurora Snow about leaving the porn industry. Very powerful piece about what it was like in terms of the, you know, challenges, because it's a situation where, you know, you, like you said, you know, Candy, it's about the situation of the money not necessarily being as fast or as abundant. So, you know, you kind of have to think about, it's like a drug dealer who's trying to go legit and he not making that bank off them bricks anymore. So it's like, yo,
it is,
I was
hard.
Thinking like,
there's a lot of withdrawal symptoms that I went through. It was definitely, it was a hard transition. But as time has went on, I've learned to budget. I have all my kids have their wants, needs, and desires met. My children go to private school. I'm doing it by myself. They have a roof over their head. Like, they don't want from anything. They take a trip 2 times a year for the most part, but they vacation at least 2 times a year. Like, all my wants, needs, and desires are met. It just took... it was a long time coming before I could get to a space where my wants, needs, and desires have been met. And I'm doing everything that I thought I couldn't do. I didn't think I would hold a degree. I didn't think I would go back to school and be successful in that. I did not think I would be working a regular job and managing this long. I did not think, I've been talking about writing this book since before I went square. And I didn't think I would actually be through with the first book, decide to write a series and be through with the first book and move and pushing towards a date for the next book of the series to come out and then the memoir. So, I mean, it was a hard transition, but it was worth it in the end. And I'm too old. It's nothing worse than watching Ali fight past his prime. That's something my uncle used to tell me all the time. I'm pushing them 40s. I'm getting real close to 40, and I'm not trying to be out there with no young girls talking about, hey, baby, you don't remember me? I'm Fiona Monroe. Done. Ain't nobody talking about no 30-something-year-old coochie.
Man, look,
it wasn't as heartbreaking.
It wasn't as heartbreaking. Larry Holmes.
Yeah. It ain't heartbreaking seeing Tyson sit down on his stoop. That broke my heart right there.
What broke your heart?
When Mike Tyson gave up.
Oh, yeah.
The
and
hood
he was
hurting so much
for that last fight. He was training hard.
Yeah, I mean,
he got me to eating, looking into buffalo meat and shit.
Yeah. <we're>... What did he just eat? Lamb meat and wheat? Like, that's his diet now?
Yeah, he was eating buffalo meat and lamb, like the leanest of lean meat. He was, I ain't going to talk about Tyson, though, too bad, because he's still alive and that nigga, he is vicious.
Oh, no, I ain't messing with Mike, man.
Tyson,
no. That's a scary sight.
Man, look,
no,
we seen Mike a few. Look, we seen Mike a few years ago when he was doing that little mini training and he was still swinging them punches. I'm like, don't act like that nigga still got that. Don't got that right hand to put you down.
Look,
I'm like, Mike is still. I'm like, look, that
I
man
ain't talking
was sick. Mike was. Mike was
54,
about 55 now. No, he's like 56 now. I mean, so but Mike, you know, when you look at what he was doing at that time. And it's so sad when you look at the situations that happen. I'll say it on air. I don't believe he raped that girl. I don't believe Desiree Washington got raped. But I do believe Mike was living a wild life at that time. And I think it was an unfortunate circumstance that, I mean, because look, you get that 1 a.m., 2 a.m. call to the hotel room, and, you know, you go, y'all do what y'all do, and by the same token, I'm not going to dismiss any woman's claims of rape. I just don't think it happened in that, you know, situation. But what I think happened with Mike was just wild, and they got him in a situation where, you know, they got him. But by no means am I or any of us ever going to dismiss it in terms of sexual crimes, you know, with heinous in all aspects. But sometimes you look at the circumstances and you're wondering, did it really, really happen the way this person is saying it happened? But that's just my 2 cents. I'm not going to get heavy on it, but I just think he just got himself in a bad situation, and he lost 3 years of his career, because had he not gone to prison, there's no telling how far he still could have gone, you know, because Mike was prime Mike. But when you look at a lot of those guys, like you said, Candy, when you think about what was going on, I mean, you look at a lot of, you know, like, I mean, you look at Bernard Hopkins, he got knocked out the ring in his last fight. You know, Larry Holmes was looking old and slow. You know, I mean,
you know, there's nothing worse. I mean, hell, even with Ace Frehley from Kiss, you know, he's not really playing the guitar like he used to. You know, it's like the one thing about it is no matter what your profession is, whether you're in the sex industry or athlete or whatever, the worst thing about it is when you stay too long. And you don't want to become a caricature of yourself because you always want to be at the top where everybody knows you at your best. And you got a lot of people, I mean, that try to hang around too long. I mean, you know, Brady, I mean, look, we ain't going to say nothing bad about Brady, but I'm like, Brady still want to play football, and he got divorced behind it. His wife, Giselle, wanted divorced behind it. Like, dude, you ain't going to stay at home? I mean, it's like, you know, but it's different out there. So, we decided to write your – yo.
Oh, okay. My phone went out for a second.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, so when you decided to write the book – tell us about the book from your first one that you wrote, and how much of it did you have to go back and recollect from those memories to write it?
The first book that I wrote is a memoir, but that's not the first one that I'm publishing. And I went all the way back to my childhood. I went back to the first time I was ever touched. I went all the way back to 8-year-old me. And I went through the feelings that I felt, being confused about what was happening, you know, things being my fault, thinking that things were my fault and not the person's fault, the adult who's taking advantage of a child. I went through my whole childhood. I go into my relationship with my mother. I love my mother dearly. Rest in peace to my mom. But we did have a complicated relationship because my mother was very young when she had me. She was only 16. And she was finding herself. She had kids too early and she was finding herself, and when you're finding yourself in parenting as a child, I didn't realize how much she was holding on to herself while raising children, while trying to find love, while trying to figure out who she was, while trying to figure out all these things, and then trying to give love that she didn't even have for herself to children. I didn't really understand that, and I go through that. I go through my experience in the sex industry, in the street. I go through everything. I go through my experience working in the anti-human trafficking movement, and the memoir, I have changed at least 5 to 10 times because there's been things like, okay, I'm going to add this in, and I'm going to add that in, and it's with writing, I don't know how musicians do, but I know as far as writing has been an escape for me since I was, the first time I seen Poetic Justice, I was like, oh yeah, that's what I'm going to do eventually one day. But anytime I write, my pieces tell me when they're done. They'll let me know, like, okay, this is complete. So it's finally in a place where it's like this part of it is complete, but I'm not the first book to go out. And that's the reason why I wrote the book that's the series, which is called Horror Stories. It's a play on the word whore. And Horror Stories starts off in D.C. It's loosely based off of, it's like an urban novel. It's loosely based off of true story, my story. Of course, I changed the names and I dramatized some situations to protect the characters' real identities. But it's about, like, Ladybug is the main character. It's about Ladybug's adventure in between Chicago, D.C., New York. There is tragedy in there. It's a lot of information. It's a lot of, I wrote this to break, like I said, I've been working in the anti-human trafficking spectrum for about 8 years working within that movement, and there's a lot of narratives that I want to break, like the girl getting kidnapped in a black van and now she's trafficked, because that's not necessarily how it happened, or a dude drugging a girl and making her do drugs. I ain't never fucked with a pimp that had his girls doing drugs. I don't know.
Drugs are bad for business.
It's bad for business. You do drugs, you might get your head cut for that. What is the drug? A drunk bitch can't get no money. A high bitch can't get no money. So there's a lot of narratives that I want to break with this book about what really goes on, and what a lot of people aren't going to like. Trigger warning. I know, you know, all this mental health stuff has been up and coming in the last 3 years. So trigger warning. I am attempting to change, to humanize the pimp a little bit. So I'm going into Patchy is the pimp story, is the pimp in the book. But I'm going into his story and him growing up with a father as a pimp and a mother as a prostitute and the things that he's seen coming up and some of the things he had to go through as a kid and the trauma bond that him and Ladybug, they built together. And it's like it's a toxic lust and love with two broken people that really don't need to be with each other at all, because they're two broken, unhealed people and they're just cutting each other down throughout the whole book. They're cutting each other, but they're empowered. She's like the Bonnie to her, she's like the Bonnie to his Clyde, and he like the Clyde to her Bonnie, you know, and they're going to go through a lot of ups and downs. And then you get to know some of the other characters, Mindy and Monica, or a couple of the other characters there, Ladybug's wife-in-law, and you'll see, like, the relationship between the girls that are with the same man, the competition, the love bond between Monica and Ladybug. It's a really good story, and I think anybody who read it is going to live it. And at the beginning of it, I added a poem in there about ladies of leisure, ladies of the night, women of the night, whores, to begin it off, break it off. I am going to start pre-sales in October, and I'm shooting for publishing no later than Halloween.
Man, I mean, when you actually sat down to write it, how did that feel to really be able to articulate your thoughts in a literary fashion, let alone getting it published?
Wait, can you repeat that one more time?
Sure. Yeah, so how did it feel when you actually sat down to start writing and let alone getting it published, like in terms of really articulating those feelings and experiences?
It was like therapy. It was a relief. It was a lot of things I had been holding in and I wanted to say and I couldn't get out, like, and I didn't necessarily know how to articulate them to other people, but it came through in the writing, and it felt good to get all of that. It was like a dump. It was better than a therapist sitting down talking to a therapist, and I've talked to a lot of therapists. It was way better than that. It was just like a relief. It felt like it was a pouring of energy that I had been holding on for so long.
Man, I mean, look, you know, because you read me some excerpts, you know, off air, and I need my copies. I need them signed. I need all that shit. Because what you said about toxic love and lust, I mean, love between broken people who keep stabbing each other, I mean, that's powerful. When you look at some of these relationships today out here with some of these celebrities, most notably with Blueface and Krishan, what do you see in a situation about how their relationship dynamics are about that? And how do you think as black people sometimes we get caught up celebrating the tragedies of drama as opposed to celebrating the peace and sanctity of stability?
misery loves chaos, and there's the addiction of chaos in miserable people. That's how I feel about it. A lot of people are miserable, and when it's quiet and they're not comfortable with themselves, and they don't become comfortable with themselves, and they spend so long uncomfortable with themselves that when it's quieted down, they have to have chaos, and it becomes an addiction. And chaos is a worse addiction than any drug there is, because they look for drama no matter what, even in the best of situations. And that has seemed to be glorified. The toxic relationship is the new thing. I don't want to be with nobody I got to argue with and fight with anymore. I don't got no more. I only got a couple of hits in me, and shoot, I might lose. I don't want to catch no fades. I don't want no smoke from nobody. So I don't want no smoke from nobody. If I never have to fight again a day in my life, I will be happy with that. I am the walk away queen now. You like, you a punk? Yeah, I am. I am. I'm going to walk my punk ass back in the house. I ain't going. You know, it's not that I am. I can. I got hands. Don't play with it now. But at
South
the same
Central
time,
Ray,
it's just something. Yeah. Don't test them. But it's something that seems to be glorified, and I really feel sorry for their relationship. I am Team Krishan, by the way. I love that little girl, but I hope that she finds herself. I hope that she finds herself, and I hope that this baby helps her find herself and get her to a place to where she's comfortable with being within herself. When the room is empty and it's just her, she's happy with just Krishan.
Yeah,
I don't think he's gonna get there, because he's addicted to the attention that he gets from the chaos.
Yeah.
That's why he keeps it going.
And, you know, we look at a lot of those relationships that we've seen, you know, especially All of Us Are Black. We've seen a lot of this stuff play out in public. We saw, you know, Andre Rice and then Left Eye, rest in peace with her. We know, I mean, look, that shit got, I mean, no, that, look, we found out.
She
that
set that,
that
man shit on fire. Set the house
she
on
burned
fire.
The house down. We
oh,
were like,
literally.
Whoa.
I mean, we saw Ike and Tina. You know, Ike and Tina Turner, we saw that situation. You know, we saw that drama. I mean, we saw the situation with Ray Rice where he knocked his wife out. And when we look at these situations, it is something that I think it speaks, because number one, to have that happen is a tragedy. To have it broadcast is even worse, because it gives people who are not black, it makes them think that we are just these total troublemakers of uncivilized, savage calamity of accidents and incidents waiting to happen, and that is not who we are as black people. We're like anybody else. Bad things happen, but bad things happen to everybody in every community and every race. But, you know, it's going to be magnified with us. And I think we as black people need to start changing the narrative. You know, that's why as long as King and yourself have known me, you know, myself, I don't do negativity. You're not going to see me on social media sharing fights or saying a whole bunch of off-the-wall shit, you know, or disrespecting somebody. It's like, you know, to me, when you start playing into those negative spirits, you invite trouble. And, you know, some people, they just get out there and it's like they think they're being funny one, and they, you know, and I'm like, really? I'm like, some of the shit I see online, I'm like, they just want attention. I'm like, but then y'all get the wrong attention.
A lot of it is attention.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Unfortunately, people don't pay attention to a lot of the positivity. They pay it there. They're more focused on the drama. People are addicted to drama. There's excitement in drama. There's a high that comes with looking at drama. It does something to the dopamine or whatever in your system. When you see drama, I personally, honestly, I don't. The last time I watched Love and Hip Hop, I'm going to tell you how I am with reality TV. The last time I watched Love and Hip Hop, Chrissy beat Kim Bella up. Man, I'm still pretty. That line. That's the last time I watched that show, because I didn't like the way it depicted, the show depicted black women. as a whole,
right.
And all those shows depict black women, and the baddies, all of these new baddie shows, I wouldn't even give those any play because I don't like the way they depict black women. It looks like Fight Club to me because they're constantly fighting. We do need to highlight the more positive aspects of ourselves. There is a lot of beauty within our culture. There's a lot of beauty within black women. There's a lot of strength within black women. There's a lot of resilience within black women that's not necessarily depicted on TV. And I always say this, everybody wants our rhythm, but don't nobody want our blues. We are also the most disrespected publicly. I am an avid believer of conversations need to stop when it pertains to black people. Black people shouldn't have some conversations in public, colorism, why black women don't respect black men, why black men don't respect black women. Black men who date outside their race are black women who date outside their race. How often publicly do you see whole podcasts where white men or a group of Mexican men or a group of Asian men are sitting talking about how they don't like of their race? They date outside their race, but you don't see them broadcasting it live for the world to see. But we do, and those are things that we have to stop as a culture.
Yeah, and I think it's such a wide and varied issue, I think, of how as black people, some of us have been raised, households we've come up in, and how we've been taught to resolve and deal with conflict. And a lot of times in some situations with some people, only the way they feel they can deal with it is to be loud, obnoxious, and boisterous. We get into this whole misnomer of being assertive, that this is the way, when a lot of times there's nothing wrong with standing your ground. And then, of course, the all-ever-present, I stand on that, or I said what I said. I'm like, well, you can say what you want to say and stand on what you want to, but the thing is, are you thinking about what you're saying and what you're standing on? You know, and when you start getting out there disrespecting people or just saying, saying shit just because, you got to think about what you're putting out there. You know, and a lot of times these people put out stuff that's really unfounded. It's rooted, in a lot of chauvinism or a lot of laziness.
Because you don't know how many times I done heard people say I don't read, or they get all their information from YouTube University.
Yeah, or I mean, the situation just about how relationships are.
Oh, they need the word one.
Look, the grifters, especially, and that's what the grifters do, the Birdman hand rub, and they come in because they just...
Oh, they know when they got a suck.
Oh.
They know when they get a chump.
Man. when you look at the situations and relationships especially, you got a generation of young girls, black women, thinking all they got to do is look pretty and a man's supposed to take care of them. You got niggas thinking that I'm going to be this rapper, I'm going to be, I'm going to be a scammer. I'm not even going to work for it. I'm just going to scam all day.
Parents got to take control of, what their kids are taking into. Stop letting the tablets and the phones babysit your kids, and you actually deal with your kids, take them out and talk to them about what they want to be, and let them go in the world and find what they want to be. We went outside and played when we was kids. These kids don't do that. They sit on GTA all day, or they sit on YouTube all day, and they're learning who they want to be from the outside world instead of learning who they want to be from at home. So, that has a lot to do with our parenting, too. And we're so busy, so focused on our mental health. Oh, my trauma, my childhood trauma. Bitch, your mama was going through shit, too. She was dealing with childhood trauma. She didn't know what she was doing. Come, let's stop. We got to stop victimizing ourselves and start taking a little bit of credit. My mom, she did some wrong things. But at the same time, I made some choices, too, that kind of created the path for my journey. So I can't put it all on her. I have to take accountability somewhere and start working on me. So
you know, we have to take control of our kids.
Being a rapper is cool, son. Being a gamer is cool. But let's go to these books and create this fallback plan. You know, being a scientist is cool, too.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with being a nerd.
No, and I'm glad to see that to a degree the nerd paradigm of knowledge has kind of been embraced a little bit more nowadays, where it was a very unwanted stigma. Because I tell anybody, any aspect of academia is always good. It's never a bad thing to be smart in anything. Matter of fact, it's survival if you're smart. Because remember, a smart person can play stupid. Stupid person can't play smart. You know,
they do it all the time, and they put them on public platforms, and they teaching your babies on what they what to do when they grow up. So be careful.
Yeah, and you know, being older now, I understand why maybe certain things, you know, it wasn't age appropriate for us. I even look at the music today, but even then, it's like there was a balance even when we listened to hip hop. You know, because me and King talk about this all the time. I'm like, look, some of that stuff that came out back in the 90s, oh, they would have lost their shit today. I mean, imagine 2 Live Crew coming out today. Oh, my God. Shout out to Uncle Luke. I mean.
Uncle Luke had us cracking at the skating rink. Put your hands up high, your back down low.
I mean, can you imagine 2 Live Crew in this day and time? The way Luke was, I mean, this was the 80s and 90s when Luke and them were getting down. I mean, you know, I mean, imagine a song like N.W.A.'s Fuck the Police coming out today. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean. Lil' Kim's hardcore album. This was 1990.
Her hardcore album, I mean, I'm trying to tell you, I was listening to that, and I shouldn't have been listening to that in 90s. When he come out, 95?
96.
I was in sixth grade talking about it. Peter Piper pecked him. I bet you Biggie bust him. Dude.
Man. He said, I bet you Biggie bust him. He told me not to fuck him. Lyrically, I dust him off. I mean, we first heard Mafia. I mean, Queen B. We were like. But that era of hip-hop, even then, we kind of knew was not necessarily something to take serious. It was just hardcore shit. But now everybody is living that as a gospel. You know, when we see the rise of the drill scene in Chicago rap, you know, we're seeing it even in New York now, it's heavy. I mean, we got kids who are really, really trying to live a life that they really don't understand. And we're seeing we're losing our young people to the streets because they're trying to emulate something. I mean, we knew. There was enough of a balance back in the day when we listened to rap, we listened to party rap, we listened to hardcore rap, we listened to R&B. Hell, some of you even listened to jazz and classical, at least I did. So we had a balance of what we weren't inundated with just one type. And it didn't allow us to be oversaturated in one part because it's like anything. And everybody tries to blame hip-hop music because it's the most prevalent, it's the most popular export this country has, it's the most popular genre in the world. So it's an easy target, especially coming from a black and brown culture of minorities. So because of that, everybody wants to blame us when the society's ills happen. The reality is hip-hop didn't create the shit. It was already there. Rap music was a way of expressing those frustrations and the despair that was going on. Then when they say, well, rap calls all, I'm like, bullshit. I'm like, the problems was already there. You can't blame. I'm like, but it's like anything. When you look at a lot of what anybody exposes themselves to, it's like if you watch too many violent movies, that's not good. You know, you watch too much porn, that's not good. You know, if you're alone too long, that's not good. You have to have an outlet, and you have to know when to not overindulge yourself in anything. Too much of anything makes you an addict, and it can make an accident waiting to happen, a catastrophe that's coming. This is how I look at it. When you think about everything that you have accomplished, leaving the industry, college graduate, author, a mother,
an advocate for positivity and social change, maintaining your sanity through all of this, because we've seen a lot of women in your industry, you know, leaving, who unfortunately, you know, either they fought, you know, HIV, AIDS, or they committed suicide because the mental stress was too much for them to overcome. You've beaten the odds. And how does it feel knowing that not only have you beaten the odds, that you've excelled in your existence and you still have a story to tell, that you're still writing?
It feels like I'm living somebody else's life a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes I look at like where I came from, and some days I'm not always like at the best, at the top. Like, it's times I look in the mirror and I doubt myself and if I am still going to make it or if this is it. But when I sit down and I think about the journey, it makes me cry sometimes. I'm not going to lie. Like, when I think about, like, where I began and where I'm at right now, I motivate me. I've always been my own competition. And it makes me want to compete harder with myself. I don't brag on myself like, yeah, I'm just the shit, and I did this, and I did that, and I did this, and I overcame this. It's still unbelievable to me. Sometimes I don't believe this is my life, and I think something is going to go wrong. There's a lot of doubt that happens within me, and there has been times where I have come to a place of nearly self-sabotage because I don't necessarily always believe I deserve what I'm getting. I just want to acknowledge that first, especially for those who do have self-doubt. But on those days, I still get up and keep going because I think of where I was the year before and the year before that and the year before that and the decade before that. I am the statistic that wasn't supposed to make it this far. People been doubting me since the beginning, since before when I was younger. People wrote me off. People still write me off. And the only thing I could keep doing is keep proving everybody wrong. And knowing going in, even though I doubt myself sometimes, I deserve everything that I'm getting because I worked for it. I work damn hard. I'm the first person up at my house at 4:30 in the morning. I'm the last person to go to sleep sometimes at 2:00 in the morning. I work damn hard on everything that I'm doing, and it humbles me that I have that in me. And I thank all the women who came before me and my family, my mother, my grandmothers, my godmother. I thank all those women for instilling that strength and going through everything they went through to not only teach me what not to do, but what to do on my journey.
And that's something in itself, for the fact that you've been able to, you know, the thing about it is, I think what you said shows the most important thing, that we're all human. And from that perspective of it, that we all go through things. Everybody has a story. Everybody has a struggle. Everybody is, you know, going through what they go through, and you always try to understand that. I tell people, be respectful of others and understanding where they're at and meeting them at times where they are, because it's about them trying to maintain. This world is unpredictable and the unforgiving. So because of that, we have to be understanding. You know.
One of my favorite lines is always be nice to everyone. Be nice to everyone, even if you don't know why they're having a bad day. Always look at it as it's not you, it's what they're going through.
Yeah.
Because we're all dealing with storms. We're all dealing with storms. Yeah, sometimes you don't know who ass whipping you might catch either. So be careful. But we all going through a storm. Everyone's going through a storm. Assume everybody is going through a storm, especially those who smile the hardest. those are the people going through the most difficult storms, and the reason why they're smiling so hard is to keep themselves from breaking and crying.
Yeah, most definitely. More than anything, it's just about how you're able to make it through. But ultimately, you know.
Hey guys, I want to send an apology for not being in and out. I had a lot of things to do
with my waking and my roof. So I've been pretty much in and out dealing with that.
It's all good, man. We've been having a great time with it. More than anything, I mean, we're about to close shop with this. Man, like I said, this is a long time coming, but it's everything that we thought it would be and so much more. Welcome back in
time.
Thank you. We support you all the way. We are so happy to be a part of that journey on your growth, that you've entrusted us to be a chapter in your life telling your story. And we take stuff like this very seriously. There's no greater story than a human experience that is told by the person that has lived their own. This is important.
Thanks.
You have a voice and it needs to be heard.
Thank you guys so much for having me this evening. Thank you guys for taking a couple of hours out of your evening and talking to me. People, look out for Horror Stories. That is the first book coming out. Follow me at Candy Baby Pen. To keep up with what's going on. And if you're in the local LA area or if I'm in your city, I might be at an open mic near you. Check out some of the spoken word. I appreciate y'all having me tonight. I do have a Twitter page, but I'm old. I don't know how to work that. I ain't even going to lie. The best place to find me is Instagram. Yeah, thank you so much for having me tonight. I appreciate it, Thomas. All right, T-Mac, I'm sorry. Y'all going to edit
okay.
that, right?
No, I mean, it's no secret. Everybody know who we are. I mean, everybody calls us by our real name. You know, I mean, so
okay.
we're not secret in the game. Everybody knows us. Look, you
okay.
know, that's part of what we do in terms of honesty on radio. We're the same guys on it, and we're all. So that's the main thing.
Okay. Well, yeah, thank you. And thank you, King, for having me. I appreciate you putting this interview together for me. I'm so grateful, so humble. Yeah, man. Oh, and then shout out to my Wolf sisters and brothers out there. I know they either listening or they might be in the middle of a show tonight. That's my poetry group, my poetry brothers
yeah.
and sisters, Wolf Hours in the building. Check us out in the den. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And obviously we'll be in touch. And we close another championship chapter, especially Candy Baby from Cali, living that Cali life just so right. King, take us out of here. I guess he might have got caught up in everything, so I'll do it.
Yeah,
okay,
King,
go take us out.
Thank you once again for joining us. Everybody that tuned in, thank you for joining us. Thank you, Candy Baby, for making episode 566 a special one. Anything you need down the line, we got you. Whatever the promotion, video drops, shout outs, whatever you need, we got you.
All right, thank you. Much love. I'll talk to y'all soon. Bye-bye.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Catch
we out.
Catch the same time, same channel. We out tomorrow. Peace.
Peace.